Hello, listeners. This is the Out of This World radio program with your host, Ted Marr, broadcasting from the studios of KKNW in Bellevue, Washington, on 1150 AM. The program focuses on out-of-this-world information, including psychic phenomena, UFOs, metaphysics, and predictions for the coming years in Seattle, the United States, and beyond. We will have only the best psychics and UFO researchers and astrologers in the world on our program, and I guarantee it will be the most interesting radio program you've ever listened to, as you will hear information here that you will simply not hear elsewhere. We are also one of the top-rated shows, talk shows in Seattle, and we are also the fastest-growing psychic and UFO program in the world, and we now have listeners in over 60 countries on all the world's continents. The purpose of this program is to raise human consciousness to make this world a better place to live, and I know with everyone's help, we can make this planet a much better place. Before I introduce my guests, I want to thank everyone in Switzerland, Japan, the United States, and Canada who's donated to the radio program. If you'd like to make a donation, even a small one, $1, it all helps. Please go to our website at www.outofthisworld1150.com and just click on it. I also wanted to tell you, too, that we're having a wonderful, it's called the Galactic Wisdom Conference next month in Port Townsend, Washington, from November 21st through the 23rd. We have a dedicated website to the conference now, and the website, if you'd like more information, is www.galacticwisdomconference.com. We will be having people coming in from Tokyo with the Emoto Peace Project. Michiko Hayashi, the head of the Emoto Peace Project, will be coming to talk about Dr. Emoto's wonderful work and the wonderful work of the Emoto Peace Project. Dr. Susan Chomsky, a famous New York spiritualist, will be coming in from New York City. Red Hawk Phoenix, a Long Island, New York healer and animal communicator, will be coming in, as well as Teresa Carroll, a well-known and accomplished Seattle psychic. Tricia McCannon, a well-known psychic and UFO contactee, will be giving a speech at the and a workshop at the conference. Gordana Burnett, a famous Swedish spiritualist, will also be appearing by Skype from Malmö, Sweden. Scott Lemriel, a UFO contactee who's had 52 years of benevolent face-to-face ET human contact, will be giving a workshop on how to contact benevolent ETs, as well as a host of local psychics and other wonderful people. On Saturday night, for those interested in seeing an actual UFO, I've asked my Galactic Alliance friends if they could send some craft over to the conference, and they promised they will. So for a truly out-of-this-world experience, please mark it on your calendars for November 21st through the 23rd. For early registrations, there is a discount, and again, just go to our website at www.galacticwisdomconference.com. The conference itself is being dedicated to Dr. Masaru Emoto, the world's most famous water scientist, whose work now is being carried on by Michiko Hayashi of the Emoto Peace Project. Dr. Emoto was a wonderful man, and we want to continue his wonderful message to everyone around the world. Before we begin, I also like to thank the many sponsors of this show, including my dear friend Carol, who's been designing my website and providing moral support, and without whose friendship and help, this program would not have been possible. My dear friend Ann Nelson, business professor at Walla Walla College. My dear friend Heidi in Switzerland, who's been helping to arrange appearances by Eric von Doniggen and other wonderful European psychics. My angelic and earthly family, as well as my wonderful sound engineer Eric Ryder and my station manager Eric Krema, without whose help this program would not have been possible. You can always listen to the show live from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. at www.1150kknw.com. And after the show, you can always listen to the audio from past shows at the radio website at www.outofthisworld1150.com. Today we have a wonderful guest in Graham Hancock. Graham, are you there?
I am indeed here, yes. Nice to finally hook up with you.
That's fine, Graham. You must have been tired after your long trip driving across the country several weeks ago.
Yeah, I was, and let's not forget the Mercury retrograde factor either.
Mm. I had an astrologist on a week ago today, Graham, talking about Mercury retrograde. Karen Winterland of Seattle, wonderful astrologist, wonderful tarot reader.
Yeah,
and she was saying, you know, she warned me before about miscommunications, about emails, about phone calls, and sure enough, and mechanical problems. Sure enough, all kinds of things happened. The windshield wipers on my car gave out. I had to get that fixed, and I had to drive through a driving rainstorm. That was a lot
yeah.
of That was a lot of fun figuring out where the lanes were on the freeway.
Yeah, I know. No, it's a real problem. I take Mercury retrograde extremely seriously, and it undoubtedly does associate with all kinds of communications problems. And yes, the last time as well, I had just finished driving 2,500 miles across North America, and I was absolutely exhausted. Since then, after that, I spent another couple of weeks in the U.S. Then I went to South Africa, and straight from the U.S. And I'm now just home a couple of days, but more or less on my feet.
Oh, good. Well, it's so good to have you here, Graham. I want to read a little bit about your background. You're the author of major international bestsellers, The Sign and the Seal, Fingerprints of the Gods, and Heaven's Mirror. Your books have sold more than 5 million copies worldwide and have been translated into 27 languages. You've made numerous public lectures, radio and TV appearances, including two major series for Channel 4 in the United Kingdom and the Learning Channel in the United States for The Lost Civilization and Flooding Kingdoms of the Ice Age. And you were born in Edinburgh, Scotland, and your early years were spent in India, where your father worked as a surgeon. Later, you went to school and university in the English city of Durham and graduated from Durham University in 1973 with first-class honors in sociology. You went on to pursue a career in quality journalism, writing for many of Britain's leading newspapers, including The Times, The Sunday Times, The Independent, and The Guardian. Graham was the co-editor of the New Internationals magazine from 1976 to 1979, and the East Africa correspondent of The Economist from 1981 to 1983. You've done some wonderful work, Graham, and I'm so happy to have you on the show today. Thank you so much for coming on.
That's a total pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
How did you ever get interested in other worldly issues and your current career path? Was that from your living in India when you were there as a young boy, or...?
I think it goes back a long way. Although initially I wasn't conscious of all these influences, I've begun to pay more attention to them as the years have gone by. Mm-hmm. See, back in the 70s and the 80s, I was totally into current affairs at a very rational, pragmatic level, and I didn't have any real interest in ancient history or in mysteries. Except current affairs mysteries. Mm-hmm. But what happened was that I was, as you mentioned, the East Africa correspondent for The Economist, and mm-hmm. that work took me regularly to Ethiopia. And in Ethiopia, I came across the intriguing tradition. The Ethiopians claimed to be the last resting place of the Lost Ark of the Covenant. And this just struck me as the most outrageous and incredible claim, but at the same time, there was a lot of supporting evidence in favor of it, and I began to dig into this story, keeping it on the back burner. It wasn't my main preoccupation initially, but during the 80s, it gradually drew me out of current affairs and into ancient mysteries. And I ended up writing my first book, my first non-fiction book of historical mystery, which is called The Sign and the Seal, A Quest for the Lost Ark of the Covenant, which was published in 1992. And so it was a process, really. It was this mystery in Ethiopia which connected to remote antiquity, which scholars scoffed at, but which turned out to have an enormous amount of supporting evidence that led me out of the current affairs arena, and into the much more interesting area of our hidden past as a species.
I have to tell you, Graham, that I went to, I have one of my degrees is in anthropology from the University of California, Berkeley. Wonderful school.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But when I was going to school there back in the mid-late 70s, of course, anything regarding the kinds of, well, how can I explain this? I don't believe we evolved from amoebas, frankly. And...
Well, I'll tell you, I might take issue with you there. I don't really care whether we evolved from amoebas or not.
Okay.
It seems to me a profoundly insignificant issue. The issue is not that. The issue is what we do with what we have. Mm-hmm. The issue is what we do with the consciousness that we have.
True.
Whether we evolved from amoebas. Look, I mean, there's a lot of nonsense talked in this area. We share 70% of our DNA with fruit flies, for goodness sake. You know, we are part of the web of life on this planet. We have 98.5% DNA in common with gorillas and a wee bit more with chimpanzees. It's foolish to pretend that we're somehow special or different or unconnected to the web of sacred life on this gorgeous planet of ours.
Sure, I agree.
I think it's a diversion. The question is, I'd be very proud to have evolved from an amoeba, frankly.
Okay.
What an achievement over billions of years to refine a physical form to the point where we are capable of making very, very fine decisions between good and evil, between right and wrong, between darkness and light. I believe that we are souls manifested in physical bodies, but I have no problem with the notion that physical evolution takes place. I don't see why that should be something to run away from or hide from or scoff at. I think it makes perfect sense. But the question is, what are we doing with the gifts we've been given? What are we doing with this life we have? That, to me, that's a much more interesting question than what we evolved from or when.
Sure. A good point, Graham. What kinds of projects are you currently working on now?
Well, you know, I'm 64 years old. I have been walking the walk of radical reinterpretation of history for the past quarter of a century or so. I'm best known for my book Fingerprints of the Gods, which looks at the possibility of a lost civilization in remote prehistory. And I am currently working on 20 years after Fingerprints of the Gods was published, because it was published in 1995. I'm currently working on a sequel to Fingerprints of the Gods, which will be called Magicians of the Gods. It's not going to be an update of the 1995 book. It's going to be a completely new book, because there has been just a huge amount of incredibly significant discoveries in the last 20 years, very, very major developments that have taken what seemed like a fringe hypothesis in 1995 into something that the mainstream is damn well going to have to take seriously, very seriously, in the years ahead. I think we are a species with amnesia. I've been saying that since 1995. And the evidence is mounting that is indeed the case, that there is a lost civilization in our background, that lost civilization existed during what we think of as the last ice age, that it was wiped out in a gigantic global cataclysm 12,980 years ago, that the epicenter of that cataclysm was in North America. That's why I was doing this huge research trip across North America with a specialist in catastrophist geology called Randall Carlson. And what we were looking at was the evidence of truly cataclysmic flooding in North America 12,980 years ago, and the evidence that this wasn't simply resulting from glacial lakes that filled up and overspilled their banks periodically, but was actually one huge event that resulted from a comet that broke into multiple fragments and hit the Earth 12,980 years ago. Four of those fragments hit what was then the North American ice cap, instantly liquidizing it, and several more of them went on crossing the Atlantic to hit the North European ice cap and caused a flooding disaster over Europe as well, and raised sea levels all around the world and plunged the Earth into an episode of more than 1,000 years of just horrific disaster. And that is the smoking gun that lost us a whole civilization, in my view. So this is one of the things I'm working on right now, which is, you know, a completely new book with completely new evidence, re-examining the lost civilization hypothesis that first really put my name before the public in Fingerprints of the Gods. But secondly, you know, because our years are finite, and I'm not getting any younger, I've long felt that I wanted to explore such narrative gifts that I have by writing novels as well. And for the last 5 or 6 years, I've also been writing a series of epic adventure novels with a supernatural twist. The most recent two belong to a series called War God. The first one is War God, Knights of the Witch, and the second one is War God, Return of the Plumed Serpent, which are novels about the Spanish conquest of Mexico. And this work as a novelist is at least as important to me personally as my perhaps more serious non-fiction work. I think it's sometimes there are ideas that are just so extraordinary that it's best to pursue them in a work of fiction rather than in a work of nonfiction, and that's partly why I'm writing novels as well as nonfiction books now.
Oh, fascinating. Fascinating, Graham. Thank you so much for sharing that with my listeners. I really appreciate it. Well, when you're, certainly when your new book comes out, Graham, I'd love to have you back, and we'd love to talk about it then to tell everyone about that. One thing I wanted to mention to you, I know that Dr. Moto was on my show on July 25th.
Yeah, wonderful man. I'm so sorry that we've lost him. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's through Michiko Hayashi, Dr. Emoto's assistant, that you and I became introduced to one another. And she broke the news to me a couple of weeks ago that Dr. Emoto had passed away. And I'm very sad to hear about that. I did an obituary to him on my Facebook page and on my website at the time.
Mm-hmm. Good. That's wonderful. Well, as I said, I'm dedicating my Galactic Wisdom Conference to him. Michiko is flying in from Tokyo to attend. There may be others from the Moto Peace Project coming as well. So for my many listeners out there who'd like to meet Michiko, she's a wonderful lady. She's doing wonderful work at the Moto Peace Project. I wanted to tell you, we did an intention experiment with Dr. Moto on July 25th when he was on my show. Mm-hmm. Graham, and I asked Dr. Moto on the air whether his intention experiments it works with rice and water, of course, but also would it work with world peace? And he says, yes, of course.
Yeah.
So we did an experiment with the directing love and light and gratitude to the Palestinians and the Israelis in the Gaza Strip.
Right.
And that was at about 3:30 p.m. on that Friday. I'll never forget the day. So then I get to where I'm staying at 8:30 that night, and I turn on the TV, Graham, and just then CNN had announced that within 30 minutes, the Palestinians and the Israelis would agree to a 12-hour ceasefire so they could bring in medical supplies and take out the wounded and food supplies. And I thought, it works. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. I mean, if we all go around the world projecting dark and negative thoughts, then negative results will follow. Mm-hmm. If we make every possible effort to project positive energy and light and love around us, then this gives a chance for the light and the love in the world to grow. But we shouldn't imagine that that's all we need to do.
Right.
Where there are profound injustices taking place and mm-hmm. profound injustices are mm-hmm. presently being done to the Palestinian people, mm-hmm. where there are profound injustices taking place, we must also take practical steps to ensure that those injustices do not continue.
Of course.
Projecting light and love is necessary but not sufficient to solving these problems.
Right. I couldn't agree with you more, Graham. There's a whole bunch of things I want to talk to you about, and I hope we can get it in an hour. But
sure.
But one of the things is that Dr. Moto had talked about having a conference next year, I believe, off of Okinawa in August of 2015.
That was the plan. I was going to go to it and very much looking forward to it. I don't know what's happened with that conference now.
Well, it's currently under consideration. But what I will be doing here is my own fundraising efforts after my conference is over with next month to raise funds for that conference to help pay for expenses,
right,
including yours, to the conference.
Right.
So that's what I'll be working on. But there's something very significant I want to tell everyone about, and I know that that I'm sure you know about this, Graham, that right off of Okinawa, the astounding thing is that there's a series of pyramids beneath this current sea level that's been there for at least 10,000 years.
Well, I would like to think that nobody in the Western world knows more about this issue than I do.
Wonderful.
Since I've personally put in more than 200 dives
on the
Yonaguni structures, and that's what you're referring to.
Yes.
Yonaguni is the most southwestern of all the Japanese islands. It lies within 100 miles of Taiwan. I was introduced to the intriguing mystery that there are structures underwater there back in 1996. And in 1997, I learnt to scuba dive in order to take a look at them. That was to be the beginning of an adventure that lasted for nearly 8 years. I put in more than 200 dives at Yonaguni itself, and I know those monuments back to front and inside out. And in the process, I learnt how to dive in extremely difficult conditions because there is a ripping current that runs past the main monuments at Yonaguni. And people who've only been there once or twice, who've maybe done one or two dives, whose diving skills are not very good, really cannot appreciate at all the magnitude or the beauty or the complicated nature of the structures that are underwater. You really have to spend time on them, as I've done, in order to get a sense of what is going on there. Now, they are not the only underwater structures in Japan. Further north, off the main island of Okinawa itself, about 40 kilometers west of Okinawa Island, west of the capital, Naha, in a group of islands called the Keramas, and off specifically an island called Akajima, we have at a depth of 110 feet underwater a majestic complex of huge stone circles on the scale of Stonehenge or larger. And again, it's been my privilege to dive on those stone circles. And in that case, I've put in about 35 to 40 dives on those stone circles, sometimes waiting in stormy weather for a week before we were able to get in the water and dive there. So this is a subject that I've really dedicated to myself to over a number of years. And I remain convinced that what we have in Japan is a huge mystery, which is connected, by the way, to the existence of megaliths above water in Japan. Mm. It's not only that we're looking at mysterious megalithic structures that have been submerged for at least 12,000 years, but also we have to reconsider the dating of known megalithic structures above water in Japan. The great thing about sea level rise is that you can actually say when it happened. Hmm. We know there was an ice age. We know it came to an end about 12,000 years ago, and that comet impact I mentioned was connected to that. Hmm. We know that sea levels rose. Sea levels are actually 400 feet higher today than they were at the last glacial maximum. That means that a huge amount of land that was above water then is underwater now. And the geological studies are very precise, and we can say at what date particular depths were submerged. And structures that are 110 feet underwater have been underwater for more than 12,000 years. And this does away with all kinds of issues about carbon dating and so on. The very fact that they're submerged by 110 feet of water proves that they're more than 12,000 years old. And it then raises questions over similar megalithic structures that are above water in Japan, which have never been properly dated. You see, you can't date stone. Mm-hmm. You can only date organic material associated with the stone. Mm-hmm. And really rather sloppy work is done, and the suggestions are made that this or that megalithic structure in Japan might be 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 years old. I think we now have to consider the possibility that all of them may be over 12,000 years old and that the dating has not been properly understood.
Graham, I have to tell you, it is such an honor to have you on my show today because you've had firsthand experience seeing these structures underwater. You've done all these hundreds of dives, and I just appreciate you so much for sharing this with my many listeners around the world.
And if the listeners want to go into detailed chapter and verse on this, my book, Underworld, Flooded Kingdoms of the Ice Age, covers the whole issue. It was published in 2002, and it documents those dives in Japan and many, many other dives that I did all around the world, because this issue of underwater structures is by no means limited to Japan. These structures are found all around the world, and they're part of the forgotten history of our civilization.
Fascinating, fascinating. I want to give out your website, too, for my listeners who want to find more information about your wonderful work, Graham. www.grahamhancock.com, that's spelled GRAHAMHANCOCK.com, or you can go to my radio website at www.outofthisworld1150.com and simply click on Graham's name for today's audio and a link to his website. You know, I'm curious, Graham. I'm sure you have lots to say about this, but what has mainstream media said about your work? Do they just simply ignore it or just not address it?
Well, it's again, this has been a process rather than one particular thing. When Fingerprints of the Gods came out in 1995, there was a massive hostile reaction from academic historians and archaeologists and from their friends in the media. Mm-hmm. After all, here am I, a journalist, and I'm saying that civilization is older and more mysterious than archaeologists have ever realized.
Right.
And archaeologists got very defensive about that and very, very angry about it. And pulled all sorts of rank and claimed that I had no right to comment on such issues. See, it wouldn't have mattered if Fingerprints of the Gods had vanished without a trace. But the problem was that Fingerprints of the Gods was a number one bestseller in multiple countries, mm-hmm. and sold millions of copies all around the world and was a very prominent book, and therefore could not be ignored. So the first strategy of the establishment when confronted by a coherently argued alternative voice is to ignore it. Mm-hmm. But when it becomes impossible to ignore it, then the next thing to do is to attack it as violently as possible and to round up the friends of the friends in the media of the academic establishment to join in that attack. So it was interesting for me. For example, there's a British magazine called New Scientist, which is a very much an establishment science magazine, which was one of the magazines that most massively attacked me in 1995 and mm-hmm. 1996 for suggesting that civilization is older and more mysterious than we thought. So it was very nice, really, and gave me I have to admit to a small sense of satisfaction when New Scientist's cover in early October 2013 bore the headline, "Civilization is Older and More Mysterious Than We Thought."
Amazing. Isn't that nice?
Yes, it was. And it had to bear that headline because there have been intriguing new archaeological discoveries which can no longer be denied and which support the basic idea put forward in Fingerprints of the Gods. And one of those discoveries is an incredible site, a megalithic site, a series of stone circles in Turkey called Göbekli Tepe, where I've now made a couple of research visits. And Göbekli Tepe was created more than 12,000 years ago. Mm. We don't know by whom. I believe it was by the survivors of a lost civilization. And then it was deliberately buried 2,000 years later. So we have a kind of time capsule. We have a place that has been underground for 10,000 years.
Wow.
And it went underground because it was deliberately buried. It wasn't covered up by sedimentation or some accidental process. The people who made it deliberately buried it the way we might deliberately bury a time capsule today. Mm. And it then remained untouched, completely untouched, for the next 10,000 years until the German Archaeological Institute found it and began to excavate it in the second half of the 1990s. And the results are now in that site. There can be no dispute about it. Unlike other megalithic sites where falsely young dates may have resulted from the intrusion of later radiocarbon, mm-hmm. In the case of Göbekli Tepe, the deliberate burial of the site sealed it off and prevented any later material from intruding, and therefore we can be absolutely certain of the date. And it's a revolutionary date because our ancestors 12,000 down to 10,000 years ago are supposed to have been primitive hunter-gatherers without the ability to organize large labor forces to feed and direct them, to have a site plan, to have astronomical alignments,
right.
to cut megaliths weighing 50 tons mm-hmm. And put them up into gigantic constructions.
Right.
You know, you don't just wake up one morning as a hunter-gatherer and say, oh my goodness, I'm going to build a huge stone circle today. Mm-hmm. There has to be a background to that. And that background right. presently is entirely missing at Göbekli Tepe. So it's mysteries like this. There's another site in Indonesia, which is currently being excavated, which is producing the same kind of very, very ancient dates, coupled with the evidence of sophisticated architecture and engineering, that are forcing establishment archaeologists and historians to reconsider their whole view of the past.
Fascinating.
They're they're very reluctant to do so.
Mm-hmm.
No scientific paradigm, no system of understanding the world that has been in place for a very long time falls without a fight.
Sure.
But this the view of the past that we've had, the very easy and comforting timeline of history that sees us going in a straight line from cavemen through the first agriculture into the Neolithic, into the first cities and so on, and finally arriving at ourselves, that can no longer stand. We do have a forgotten episode in human history. Something happened during the Ice Age that has not been explained. And to me, this is just one of the great mysteries of all time.
Well, I so appreciate you being on the program today, Graham. I just want to take a quick station break and say, for those who are just tuning in, this is Out of This World Radio International with your host, Ted Marr. We're interviewing Graham Hancock, a fascinating man from England now, on his ancient history research. One thing I have to ask you is, when you drove across the United States here recently, what kinds of things did you see? Did you see evidence of a cataclysmic ice age disruption in North America?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, that evidence is all across North America. Hmm. Once you get up into the higher latitudes,
mm-hmm.
My journey took me from Oregon into Washington State, into Montana, into North and South Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for that journey was that this was the area that was just south of the ice cap during mm-hmm. the Ice Age.
Mm-hmm.
And when we speak of an ice cap, you need to realize that we're talking about mountains of ice
mm-hmm.
that are 2 miles deep, which mm-hmm. are sitting on top of North America, everywhere north of that line.
Fascinating.
And the evidence is now in that there was a sudden cataclysmic melting of that ice cap 12,980 years ago. Scientists have been aware for 40 or 50 years that there had been cataclysmic events, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But the existing theory was that huge amounts of water had pooled in what are called glacial lakes on top of the ice caps.
Mm-hmm.
And those glacial lakes had burst their ice dams periodically and spilled out large amounts of water, which had scarred the landscape. The new evidence now is connecting this whole thing to a mysterious episode called the Younger Dryas. Geologists have been aware of this episode for a long time but didn't know what caused it. The recognition is now in that our planet was hit by a comet. It's not the first time we've been hit by comets, and it won't be the last time. But this was a particularly bad episode. It was a comet that broke up into multiple fragments. Those fragments may have been as much as half a mile or a mile in diameter.
Wow.
And four of them hit the North American ice cap. And that those impacts, when a comet comes in at hundreds of thousands of miles an hour with an object the size of a small city, what it does is, as it hits the Earth, it creates an enormous quantity of heat. Now, the fact is that these fragments hit the ice caps, so what you don't have is a crater in the ground. Instead, the crater was caused in that 2 mile thick ice. Okay, and it caused the ice to liquidize instantly, unleashing literally oceans of water that poured down over Washington State, creating the Cheney Palouse Scablands, creating upper and lower Grand Coulee.
Okay,
carrying with them icebergs in which were enchained huge boulders. That's why you can go to quite a number of places across Washington State and see what are called glacial erratics sitting up at, for example, at a place called Wenatchee. We've got an 18,000-ton boulder that comes from about 100 miles away, all right, that is sitting 500 feet up the side of a valley. How did that get there? It was carried down by floods more than 500 feet deep, traveling at 50 to 60 miles an hour.
Wow.
And that boulder was enchained within a huge iceberg. And when that iceberg bumped against the side of the valley and grounded there and the floods passed on, the iceberg was left in place. And gradually the ice melted around the boulder that it contained, and we're left with this huge 18,000-ton boulder now sitting 500 feet above the valley floor. And it's one of thousands.
Well, I have to tell you, Graham, that where I'm broadcasting here in the studios of Bellevue, I'm just outside Seattle, and the location you're talking about is only 2 or 3 hours away. So
Yes, it's close.
So
Go, if anybody wants to go there, go and see Dry Falls.
Oh, I was just going to mention Dry Falls.
And see Dry Falls because they are part of this story. Dry Falls between Upper and Lower Grand Coulee, the most extraordinary thing. I mean, everybody's heard of Niagara Falls, right?
Right. Right.
Well, Niagara Falls is the result of thousands of years of erosion. Dry falls were created in less than 2 weeks. They were created by the most cataclysmic floods that the Earth has ever seen. They are 5 times wider and 3 times higher than Niagara Falls.
Dry Falls, from my listeners in Washington, is located about 40 minutes north of Moses Lake.
And that's right.
Moses Lake from Seattle is maybe 2.5 to 3 hours if you stick to the speed limit. But it's an amazing geological area because it just drops off completely.
It's the most incredible thing to see and to imagine the volumes of water that poured across it. And this was not just water, by the way. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was a mess, this flood. This was whole forests ripped up by their roots. This was boulders tumbling in the floodwaters. This was icebergs jostling together. The whole thing was thick with mud and goo. It wasn't just like clear, pure water. It was a really dark, turbulent, heavy brew of water that poured down in just gigantic quantities over this landscape. Now, if you go to Dry Falls today, you'll see the notice boards that have been put up. You can go to the visitor center, and there you will find the prevailing theory, which itself was an unorthodox theory 50 years ago, but which has gradually come to be accepted, which is that, yes, they say there was cataclysmic flooding, but it was caused by glacial lakes emptying out periodically. And they speak particularly of glacial Lake Missoula, which was in that area. The new evidence that I'm going to be presenting in my book and which Randall Carlson, who I had the privilege to travel with, has been working on for the past 20 years, ties this unequivocally to a single cataclysmic event 12,980 years ago, which is the comet that caused the episode of global climate change called the Younger Dryas. And evidence for this comet impact has actually been coming in from all around the world in the last 7 or 8 years. So we're in very new territory here. We are in the process of radically reinterpreting evidence that has been understood in one way for the last 50 years, but now needs to be understood in context of new science as North America being at the epicenter of a global cataclysm called the Younger Dryas. And there are nanodiamonds scattered all over the world. There is a layer of platinum in the Greenland ice caps. There's a phenomenon called a black mat, which is found all around the world, which is the result of forests bursting into flame and instantly carbonizing. All of these things we're now understanding were the result of one cataclysmic event, and we can date that event to within 5 years, to 12,980 years ago.
My goodness. Well, Graham, I just want to take a quick station break again. For those who are just tuning in, this is Out of This World Radio International with your host, Ted Marr, broadcasting from the studios of KKNW here in Bellevue, Washington, just outside Seattle in the United States. We have a wonderful guest on today, Graham Hancock, coming to us live from England. Graham, I have to ask you, this is such an interesting area you've talked about. This has happened in the past, and it's funny how science hasn't recognized it yet, but I think you're making wonderful work in educating certainly academics and the media and the public as to what's really happened in the past.
Well, some academics are already online with this. There are huge numbers of geologists who now recognize it's really not seriously a matter for dispute anymore that the Earth was hit by a comet 12,980 years ago. The evidence is in. You might find one or two academics who still dispute it, but the vast majority of geologists are absolutely on side on that issue. That comet impact caused the Younger Dryas, which was a sudden deep freeze. The Earth was coming out of the Ice Age 12,980 years ago. But then for the next 1,400 years, it went into a radical, unprecedented deep freeze. That's what the Younger Dryas is. And we now understand that that was caused by the huge amounts of dust that were thrown up into the upper atmosphere by the comet impacts, mm-hmm. which shut off the sun's rays for the next 1,000 years, more than 1,000 years, so that it didn't actually clear until 11,600 years ago.
If I could just finish.
Mm-hmm. The Younger Dryas is understood. Its connection to a comet impact is now understood. The next step is to realize what effects this had in North America. This is the really new evidence that the North American ice cap was hit by fragments of this comet, and that the flooding events that we see in North America were not caused by glacial lakes spilling out their contents, but were caused by an instantaneous liquidization of the North American ice cap.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Fascinating, Graham. You know, and it also fits in. I had another author on a few months ago named Shirley Andrews. She's written several wonderful books about Atlantis and Lemuria.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the end of this ice age, and the hitting of these comets coincides with her dates as well as the end of Atlantis.
Yeah, and this is a global tradition,
right?
And it's amazing how all the dates tie up. What we've lacked until very recently is the smoking gun, but we have it.
Right. Amazing. Amazing. You had mentioned two of your adventure epic novels. Are they focused in on Central America?
Yes. The War God series is about the extraordinary events of the Spanish conquest of Mexico, when 490 Spaniards in 11 ships led by Hernan Cortes turned up on the coast of Mexico to take on the might of the Aztec Empire. The Aztecs could put 200,000 men into the field, and they were an unbelievably brutal, militaristic civilization. The Spanish, if anything, were even worse. And we have this epic conflict that takes place between the years 1519 and 1521. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling the story of that adventure and of the human beings who passed through it. It was truly a time of darkness. Mm-hmm. And what interests me is the capacity for love, the capacity for courage that human beings maintain, even in the most difficult times. Mm-hmm. And I have tried to focus in on that in the storytelling, and also to show the adventure. I mean, for example, there had never been the Native American peoples, the Aztecs, had no idea what horses were, for example.
Wow.
They when they faced a cavalry charge, they had no idea what they were confronting. To suddenly have 16, Cortes only had 16 cavalry, but 16 heavy horse bearing down on you at 30 miles an hour with their hooves shaking the earth, the men on their backs armored in steel, the horses themselves armored in steel. This caused panic amongst the Aztecs. They'd never seen anything like it. Initially, they thought that they were dealing with supernatural beings, part deer, part man. Mm-hmm. The Spanish also used dogs as weapons of war. They had mastiffs. They had wolfhounds, which were trained to relish human flesh. They had more than 100 of these animals, which they threw into battle against their enemies. And this actually is how the Spanish managed to defeat vastly superior numbers of foes, because they had this, if you like, military technology, which was not available to the Aztecs. So it's a story of adventure and courage, and there are courageous and good people on the Aztec side of the story as well. There was a great hero called Xicotenca, who was the battle king of a people called the Tlaxcalans, who the Aztecs had been using as a farm for human sacrifices for 200 years.
Wow.
Cortes expected that Xicotenca would immediately join him to overthrow the Aztecs. But Xicotenca was a man of principle, and when he looked at Cortes, he saw not only the doom of the Aztecs, his enemies, but also the end of the whole civilization of Central America.
Mm-hmm.
For that reason, he fought Cortes tooth and nail. Mm-hmm. And there's women in the story. There's a historical figure, amazing woman called Malinal, who became Cortes's mistress and the mother of his child, who was his interpreter, who had a huge grudge against the Aztec emperor Moctezuma and used Cortez as her instrument to bring him down. And what I've tried to do is to bring all these characters and all these events together with a supernatural twist to the story into a series of epic adventure novels. The first one is called War God, Knights of the Witch. It was published in 2013. The second one, War God, Return of the Plumed Serpent, was published just a couple of weeks ago. And if readers go to my website, grahamhancock.com, you can link to the War God page immediately and see some chapters to read free online and some background material on these stories to see whether it's something you're interested in or not. And I'll make a special offer to your listeners and only to your listeners and only for the next week. If you write to me at the following address, War God Dedications, WARGODDEDICATIONS, War God Dedications at gmail.com. And if you show me proof of purchase, I will send you, at my own expense, a signed, dedicated bookplate to place inside your copy either of War God 1 or of War God 2 or of both. You have to write to me at War God Dedications, plural, at gmail.com, wargoddedications@gmail.com, and give me your postal address so that I can airmail you the bookplate. And a bookplate is simply a fancy name for a label that gets stuck inside the title page of the book. And unfortunately, I won't be able to get into personal correspondence. I've just got so much writing on my plate at the moment. The last time I made this offer, I ended up replying to almost 5,000 emails.
Oh,
and
no.
I can't do that anymore, but I will, okay. I promise, send the signed dedicated bookplates if you take up this offer in the next week.
Graham, and I know you're busy and you probably can't come to our conference next month, but we'll be having another Galactic Wisdom Conference the early April 4th and 5th here in the United States, and you're welcome to attend if you can.
And it'd still be a little bit too soon for me.
I'm due to
deliver Magicians of the Gods, the sequel to Fingerprints of the Gods, by the end of May.
Oh, all
and
right.
I have a feeling that I'm going to be writing right up to the wall on
okay.
that one.
All right.
Become a free man again roughly from June next year.
All right. Well, we're planning on having the Galactic Wisdom Conference twice a year, once
right.
in the spring and once in the fall. This is the inaugural one. But the other thing I wanted to tell you, too, and we can talk about this off air if you like, is to have your publisher send some of your wonderful books to me at the conference. I'll set up a table. I know people would be interested in your works and would love to buy your publications. So,
great. Well, we'll talk about that off air. We can exchange emails on that. I'll organize that with pleasure.
Okay. Wonderful. Wonderful.
But meanwhile, let me repeat that offer. Go to my website, grahamhancock.com. Go to the War God page. Check out the background to the War God novels. And if you're interested and you buy either the paperback or the Kindle edition of the novel, write to me at wargoddedications @gmail.com. Give me your postal address and I'll send you bookplates to put inside them.
I have always thought for many years, Graham, that we humans on this planet are powerful spiritual beings capable of doing immense good and doing positive, wonderful change on this planet. And thank you so much for sharing your historical perspective of your research into what's happened in the past, because this fills in a lot of blanks for people. They're kind of wondering. I've always wondered about ancient history, and you've given us a glimpse into it, and I would hope through your research that more and more people will become interested in that, especially in the academic departments across the country and around the world, that they actually would start doing that kind of research that you're doing, and not be ridiculing you or making fun of you.
Well, it's okay for that to happen. You know, mm-hmm. I have to. Anybody working in the field of alternative ideas has to expect criticism.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of the deal, mm-hmm. And in a way, that criticism is helpful because it forces us who are exploring alternative ideas to up our game and to do the very best that we can. You know, to present good and solid and worthwhile evidence. And you're absolutely right that we are spiritual beings. That mm-hmm. is what humanity is about. Our society conspires to delude us into believing that we are just material creatures,
right.
and that we have no other function here apart from producing and consuming. And that is actually a diversion from our real mission, which is the perfection and the growth of our souls. That's the opportunity the universe has given us
mm-hmm.
by allowing allowing us to live a life in a human body is the opportunity to learn and grow and develop in this theater of experience. And what I do see is people waking up to this all around the world. There isn't a light growing today, particularly amongst young people. I'm very active on my Facebook page. And by the way, that's linked off the opening page to my website. I'm very active on my Facebook page. I communicate there every day, and I have a growing community of people who come to that page every day. And what I see is an awakening amongst the youth on our planet. And that's not confined to one country or one nation. It's a global phenomenon. It's slow at first, but it's growing, and it's growing rapidly, and it's going to change everything, I hope, within a relatively short period of time. It seems that we live in dark times just now, but the light is growing everywhere.
Oh, absolutely. I started my radio program just a year ago, and since that time, it's become one of the most popular radio shows in Seattle. And it's also the fastest growing psychic and UFO program in the world right now, with listeners in over 60 countries. So I know that this is tapping into an energy of positive change. Nostradamus back in the 15th and 16th centuries said that by the 2030s and 2040s we would have the beginning, the start, and I think it started now actually early, of 1,000 years of spiritual peace and prosperity and spiritual growth. So I couldn't agree with you more. Things are changing. And the other thing, too, to remember, this year in particular, I had Susan Miller, a wonderful astrologist from New York City, on my program in April. And, Graham, she said that this year would be a year of truth, that things that are true will become truer and more self-evident, like your work, for example, in ancient history, and things that aren't true, that aren't supposed to work out, would fall apart. And I think having you on my program, the publication of your works this year and your continued wonderful work, is evidence that the truth is coming out and people are, in fact, waking up.
Yeah, I see it happening everywhere. Mm-hmm. Good people all around the world who are throwing off the chains of old ideologies and the old ways of doing things, and are finding new ways to do things. The internet's playing a huge part in this. It's a kind of global telepathy. Not everything about it is good, but it's allowing like-minded people from many different cultures to join hands all around the world, and it's in our own hands now. We can create a better world. We do have the choice. We are not helpless. There is hope. There is light.
Absolutely, and this is why I'm having my Galactic Wisdom Conference next month in Port Townsend, Washington, outside Seattle, from November 21st to the 23rd. To raise consciousness. I'm having some wonderful, excellent people coming in from as far away as Tokyo and Sweden and Los Angeles and New York. We've got about we've got about 2 minutes left, Graham, and I just wanted to tell my many listeners that please stay tuned. We will be interviewing Dr. Helena Steiner-Horstein next hour, along with Michael Sheraton, wonderful dream interpreter here. But I wanted to I want you to have the rest of the time, Graham, to give some parting thoughts to my listeners. You have about a minute and a half.
Well, this is my first opportunity to talk to your listeners, and I would say if possible, please go to my website and go to my Facebook page and come talk to me on my Facebook page. It's linked right off the opening page of my website, and it's one of the best ways for us to communicate. I've got a community of 180,000 plus people on my Facebook page, and it's growing.
Wonderful.
And we're focused around positive and worthwhile ideas and alternative thinking about the past and about the human condition.
Fantastic, Graham. Well, I so appreciate you coming on today. I hope that you can come to one of our Galactic Wisdom conferences.
I'd love to. I wish you luck with your upcoming conference. And maybe in the fall of 2015, I can get over and join you there.
Wonderful, wonderful. I also, after the conference is over, starting in December, I'll also be doing fundraising for the August 2015 possible event in Dr. Emoto's honor off Okinawa.
Yes, that'll be a tremendous event. Japan is another country that's waking up. It's another country where people have been in many ways psychically oppressed for a very long time. But I've been privileged to have a deep and long acquaintance with Japan. My son is married to a Japanese woman, and he lives in Kyoto. I've probably made, I can't count the number of trips I've made west. I see the light of a new awakening rising in Japan as well. We're all part of it, and it's our responsibility to make this better world. We shouldn't just dream about it. We have to do it.
Well, Graham, we have to go now, but thank you so much for your parting thoughts. And listeners, please stay tuned for Dr. Helen Steiner from Sweden and Michael Sheraton, a wonderful Irish dream interpreter.